Mr. Fractal Encrypt, welcome back, my friend.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here, Fractal. You absolute legend, you.
I appreciate you guys.
I'm going to start by telling a story. So 3 days ago, I got a message at 7:20 in the morning saying, hey, you guys have a power drill? I need to steal the TV from my hotel room.
Who'd you get that message from?
Yeah, from some anonymous artist of some kind. And I reply like half hour later because I'm not seeing the message until I wake up like closer to 8. And I'm like, nah, sorry, dude, we don't have a power drill right now. Usually don't bring power drills to the conferences. And I get a reply back. Nah, dude, it's just cool. I went off to the venue and brought my power drill and stole the TV. So, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. I can get into that. It's part of my philosophy of not letting obstacles get in the way of your mission. So if you're on mission, you just can't let little things stop you. So, you know, certain things have to be done and things come into your way. And I think obstacles are one of those things in life that they just see if you're really serious about it. You know, they just come up to see, you know, if you're not serious about it, the obstacle comes up, you go away and you don't actually ever achieve what you were trying to get. But if you're serious about it, you try to move the obstacle out of the way. If you're successful at it, then you actually reach your goal. So in this case, I had taken some videos of my artwork and I thought it was important to show the videos next to the artwork because I had basically put a cover over the artwork so people couldn't touch it and go and play around with it because it's mirrors and it easily gets fingerprints. So I just wanted to protect it as best I could. But I also wanted people to see that it was functional and it actually worked. And part of that working is motion. And the only way to show that would have been to do it with a video. So I had asked the conference organizers, you know, hey, can I get a TV? And, you know, it was a little late in the game. You know, I probably could have asked earlier. And it's been busy, so I'm not sure if I really did or not. So I'm just going to say I didn't ever ask for one previously. So I asked for one late in the game and they were very kind and they tried and they said, okay, we're gonna try. We'll get you one by tomorrow. And the event wasn't really starting until tomorrow. So that was going to be fine. Late at night, I sent a message to the, you know, the organizers saying, hey, were you able to get the TV? I didn't hear back. So then in the morning, it's probably 6:37. I was first thing, like ready to get to work. So, hey, you know, sending him a message. What's going on? Do we have a TV by chance? And he sent me a message back that, hey, I'm sorry, I forgot to ask yesterday and now it's too late. Period. You know, he didn't say period, but there was a period there in the sentence and it felt very final. And I'm like, I need a TV. You know, this is not an acceptable answer. So I need to just figure it out myself. So I just sent him a message. I said, okay, no worries. I'm just going to do this myself.
Yeah. And the TV is back in place in the hotel room now. Everything went fine. So you didn't really steal the TV. You borrowed it, of course.
Well, you just skipped right ahead, didn't you? So anyways, he tells me I can't have a TV. I'm like, my first thought is that, you know, I'm going to go find a local store. I'll go purchase one and then I'll, you know, buy a TV and a stand to display it. But part of me was thinking, you know, if I get a stand, I'm going to have these cables that are running around. That's just not going to look nice in an art gallery on the white walls. And for it to look nice is actually more important for me than to have the video. So it has to kind of have all these things in place first. So it just didn't seem possible to go to a store and actually manifest all this at the same time. So I just happened to look on the wall in front of me and there was the answer staring me in the face. You know, so I said, you know what? Like, what the heck? Let me see how this works. So I just looked underneath and saw how, you know, if I could actually pull the TV off, and you couldn't, you know, there was actually like, it was secured in with two screws. Two screws are easy to remove if you have a screwdriver. So realistically, I knew that I was not far away from having a TV at this point. So you guys had all this equipment. So I figured, hey, you know, if anybody's going to have like, you know, a screwdriver or a drill, it's probably these guys. And so I messaged you and yeah, I didn't hear back for half an hour. So probably in like 10 minutes, I was already at the venue getting the thing and already back here by the time you were messaging me. And yeah, I had a drill. I popped those two screws out. And as soon as I had the two screws out, I saw another answer to another problem. It had like the wall mount. super clean. So I was able to just pull the wall mount off too. And, you know, then when I got to the gallery, I just, you know, installed everything and went onto the wall just beautifully, exactly. It fit like perfectly, like I almost had planned it. And yeah, and then just at the end of the event, I took all the art off the wall. I took the TV off the wall. I brought it back here. And well, I guess, yeah, the first thing is, how did I get it out of the hotel? So, you know, I was a little concerned about that. Like, hey, are they going to notice me just like walking out with the TV? Because I didn't really have a bag that big to put it in. So I just figured I'd chance it. And I just, you know, went down the elevator. I brought the TV with me. And I was lucky that the lobby just happened to be full at that moment of people. So nobody saw me. Nobody paid attention. I just scooted on out. And pretty much the same thing when I came back to, it was like busy lobby. So I used that same camouflage to scooch back up to my room. But I had a big problem when I got it back, because these doors lock if you, you know, if you don't have the key. As soon as you close it, they lock. And there's a weird function where you have to kind of put the key into the door to make the lights work in the room. So I opened the door, I put the key in the thing, and I had actually taken one of their bellhop carts up, because it was a TV and I had a whole bunch of other bullshit from that. I had the sculptures with me and everything. So I had taken one of their bellhop carts into the hallway, and I brought everything into the room except for the TV. And I was like about, I went back out to go get it. Some other guy just happened to walk in between me and the door and the bellhop cart at the right moment. And I lost it, and the door closed on me.
Oh no.
And I had a bellhop cart with a very incriminating TV sitting on it that was not on the wall in my room. So I knew if I had to ask them to like help me get into the room, they might want to come up. I didn't have my ID on me, so I wasn't sure if they were going to even believe me that that was my room without going to it. So I knew I was like about to get busted at this point. And I was like, oh, I'm walking up. Oh, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but that's what I was like. And I was like, okay, you know what? Maybe I could just, people sometimes, they just don't look around. They don't pay attention to a lot of details. So I actually just put it in a corner in a nondescript place. And I figured, okay, I'll go downstairs and see what happens. And yeah, they just gave me a new key. I went back up and it was no thing, but it was a stressful moment when the guy like, and he knew it. He felt so bad when he saw what happened. Cause he's like, oof, you want me to stay here and guard the TV? I was like, no, man, I'm going to figure it out.
It's a great story, but yeah, the thing looked fantastic, especially with the little video above it. And the thing is, yeah, you say moving parts, and this is because this particular piece is actually a computer.
Yes.
Can you tell us about it, please?
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to. Yeah, yeah. It was a project that I did using a cryptographic protocol called Codex 32, and this is developed by some of the guys at Blockstream, Andrew Polstra, and a NIM called Pearl Wart Sneed. And these two have developed a method that you can use to create Bitcoin keys offline without using any computers, not trusting any software, hardware, or anything like that. And I love low technology things. And I actually don't trust anything at all in life, as you probably know very well. So I like something like this where you can actually do all the processes yourself. Any math that you have to do, you do by hand on pen and paper. And it's very simple to see whether you've done it correctly or not. If you've done it correctly, then you've actually created some Bitcoin keys. If not, then you know that it's very obvious that you've done it wrong. I think I've got a little off track, so let me kind of back up a little first. So the Codex 32 protocol allows you to create Bitcoin keys without trusting computers. It also allows you to split the keys into separate parts. So if you wanted to make a 2-of-3 setup where you need two of three keys to recombine your secret key, you can do that. And then there's also a method, of course, to take those split shares and recombine them. So what I made was a set of three computers. The first one does the key creation, the second one does the key splitting, and the third one does the key recovery. So to me, I think it's very interesting protocol. If you create keys with a software wallet, for example, it takes you 2 seconds. You know, it's no problem at all. If you're super duper cypherpunk and you're going to roll dice to create your seeds, the fact is you can't actually roll dice to create the entire seed. You can roll dice and create 11 words or 23 words. You can't create the 12th word or the 24th word by dice rolls, because it's something called a checksum, and it verifies that you actually have a valid seed. So you can't just roll that one. It has to actually be computationally correct in order to be a valid Bitcoin seed. So even the super cypherpunks end up having to trust a computer at the end. And there's just so many reasons not to trust computers. You know, there's something that says even a computer that's working correctly could be working against the interests of the user. So it's always best to limit those type of variables if you can, I think so.
Yeah. So if you want to be self-sovereign, you go and buy an art piece for like What did it, you auctioned it out?
Yes, I auctioned it out, and we had a whole art gallery there, and I did an auction of it, and I auctioned, so it was like all three pieces as a set, and it was very successful, I think. It went for 0.76 Bitcoin, which is really amazing, and that person gets the whole set, and to me, I think it's, you know, it's just a really cool technology to be able to say that you're able to go through the whole process yourself. Everything is done yourself. And if you didn't want to pay 0.76 Bitcoin to, you know, for a very fancy version, you can actually go online, and there's a website called secretcodex32.com, and you could just go ahead and print and cut your own paper computers that will do the same process. And there's even a BIP39 paper computer that I saw recently that a guy's been working on. Unfortunately, it has that last step where you do need a computer too. And so that's why I didn't work with that. BIP39 is much more popular, obviously. But the people that made the Codex 32 spec have some very interesting words in their book about BIP39. So they kind of do shots fired stuff and say that, you know, the checksum of a BIP39 password is only one word long, and it's going to fail to detect. Sometimes it will fail to detect even one error, and it has the quality of making your Bitcoin seed a non-standard length. And, you know, they have a couple other things that they say that they just don't like about BIP39. And it's very interesting to see, like, these things that I had kind of never considered about BIP39 before. So even though I use it myself, BIP39, I just think it's interesting to see people that look at things so deeply, and it kind of changes your perspective on it too. So I always try to find something that's an interesting project that I can learn and grow from. And the Codex 32 was so difficult for me to understand at first. I just loved it, you know, cause it was like, I could tell it was a very interesting project, and it was something you kind of had to wrap your mind around. And, I had to actually go through the process of using it before I could really get my mind around it. So I think, And I will give you some credit here, as I've done before, is that we happened to be sitting on a balcony and watching the sunrise in Madeira, and you had just made a comment to me that a lot of my work was self-similar in the fact that it's kind of circles that do, you know, Bitcoin circles, and that I was just making a lot of circles. And I was like, okay, that kind of makes sense, because if I actually look past all my previous production, is pretty much all circles. And the interesting thing to me is they all look wildly different. You know, like to me, it looks dramatically different because I'm super into the details, and even like a little change in probably one of my series would look wildly different to me. But to other people, say like that aren't looking at it in that same way, it may look self-similar. So I had actually done a Codex 32 prototype where it actually, in order for me to do what I was saying that I was doing earlier, was to actually make the keys. I had to go through the process, and I made one that was basically just a wooden version of it, just to see if I, you know, the dials worked and I can actually do it and make something that was functional, for example. And so that was step one. And when I actually used it, it was just, you know, it was just so cool. But like, wow, this is actually neat. It's much cleaner than the paper computers looked, to be honest. And it was just neat to see something that was functional and actually that you built, and it's actually doing computations. One of the really, the first computer does these Betch 32 editions, and it's something that I had never encountered before, but basically all the letters of the current Bitcoin addresses that we use, there's 32 characters in them, and it's called Betch 32. That's the address format. And there's an addition that you can do. So you can take any of those 32 characters and add them against each other. So, okay, I'm going to take Q and 3 and see what they add up to. And anytime thing times Q is always itself. So Q times 3 is going to be 3. And 3 times Q is always going to be 3 also, and Q times Q. So basically, like, what it is it's deterministic in the sense that, like, 1 plus 1 is always 2. You never get a different result. So because every time you move this wheel to this number, every single character in there is always going to be identical. I could do this process today. I could die, and then 50 years from now, you know, one of my family members can move the wheel to the same exact position that I have in my key setup, and verify, like, there's nothing that will change, you know, between now, 50 years and 1,000 years from now with the same technology. That's why I think it's so powerful, because a hardware wallet, I mean, say 10 years might be the max time that you would think a hardware wallet would be good for, just due to, like, maybe insecurities that might pop up, or even just functional things. Like, there's just, like, a hardware is not going to last forever. So any kind of computational storage is basically easy to compromise. So you really need steel or something like that as your storage method, I think, in addition to I think electronics are just not reliable for super long-term storage. So,
no. And speaking of Madeira, I mean, it's so I'm so happy that you made it to Europe twice this year. Like we last time we met before that was in Miami, and it's always so great to see you and have these conversations with you. And you never know where things end up. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but you just told me in Madeira that you built the auction site where you auction out the art all by yourself. So it's you're like DIY to the fullest extent.
I did build the auction site myself, which it was cool because that way I could kind of create it the way that I wanted to create it. And that was also a neat thing about the art gallery at Madeira, was that they gave me a lot of leeway to do it the way that I thought would be neat. And so I think the gallery that we had at Madeira was, you know, I've never seen an art gallery that was cool like that, because it was like exactly how I would want it to be. So I think things like allowing you to have your vision and kind of put it in play into reality is very life-changing. And I think even when you came to Miami, I honestly didn't see myself traveling to Europe for a long time because the travel restrictions were just so heavy. And it was just such a hassle to travel that we didn't know when that was going to stop. So I just didn't see it. And I honestly haven't gotten to travel in a long time. So to get to do two events out of the country and get to hang out with all these Bitcoiners and you guys specifically, it's just it's so rewarding, because what's happening is that I'm actually getting to see the world using art as the vehicle that I travel through. And that's always been my vision. You know, I always want to kind of use the art. I think that's the real benefit of the art is that it can help me, you know, kind of grow and experience new things as a person. And I think one of the things is you got to stack experiences, you know, you got to go different places and put yourself in situations that aren't just you sitting in your bedroom at home. You know, like there's more out there in the world. It's easy to sit in the bedroom at home. It's comfortable. But, you know, I think putting yourself outside the comfort zone is super important.
Absolutely. 100%. And are I think this conference, the art gallery in Madeira was fantastic, but this one here, it's the gallery itself is simpler, but the three artists they have, like you and Apex and Madex, you are like the three top-notch artists in the space. And did you, were they using your site for all the art auctions?
Oh, yes. I got distracted there. Yeah, we did use my site for all the auctions. So that was another thing. So the auction site, I think, was something that was really powerful in the sense that it gave me a vehicle to kind of remove middlemen and remove third parties from being able to sell my art, which is super unusual for artists. Like most artists are beholden to a gallery. You know, they don't sell their own art. You know, it's like they make the art and they're good at art stuff. But they don't actually worry about any of the sales part. And I don't have anybody that's going to do the sales for me, so I pretty much have to do it myself. So in the past, I was, 100% of my marketing is basically Twitter posts. I don't have really any other marketing plan. So I just post pictures on Twitter or videos, and people will usually message me with kind of how I first sold things before we did any auctions. And then I think in December of 2020, Scarcity did their first auction. And they were like a Bitcoin only auction site, Lightning, Mainchain. It was really cool physical art. And I thought it was amazing. So I did my first auction with them, I think in February of 2020. And Sailor bought the sculpture right after that auction. So like that was a very big deal for me. And I pretty much felt like we grew together for pretty much that whole year. Like me and Scarcity together were really having a lot of growth and having a really, you know, a really good integration. But I think over time, we just became a little ideologically opposed, because I tend to be very hard line with some of the way that I do things. And they were very free form, and they kind of wanted to be inclusive of a lot more art that, say, would like tokenize things. And they kind of went full on into the ordinals and the NFT. You know, they kept it on Bitcoin, which to me was even worse. So I love them. I think they're great. I love what they do. But I didn't want to kind of display my art next to a lot of that, because I felt, number one, it may legitimize that in some way. And also, I just didn't want to be a part of any of that. It felt scammy in some sense. Like, I just don't like the tokenized art, because I'm not, the more I look into it, the more unreal it seems. Like, I've never been able to hit a point where, oh, this seems like a really awesome, wholesome idea, and it's good vibes and stuff. So to me, I didn't want to be a part of that. And then BitBlock Boom, I wanted to display, because it's like a Bitcoin only conference. And but Scarcity was doing the like the art gallery there. So I said, okay, like I had reached out to them. They told me, oh, Scarcity's doing it. I said, okay, fine, let's see, you know, what's up. So we'll do an auction together. And we did an auction and it went well. And then at the end, like the buyer actually told me that he paid for the auction using a credit card. And I was like, that was a little too far for me at that point, because I really wanted to be Bitcoin only. And even though I did get paid in Bitcoin, yes, they pay me in Bitcoin. I just didn't like the fact that the buyers were able to pay in credit card. That could be horrible on my part, but I wanted it to be like I have a purity test, I guess, in some sense. It may be horrible to say that, but I just wanted it to be how I want it to
be.
No,
but it's like someone selling puppies and they don't want to sell their puppies to someone who's mean to dogs, right?
Sure. It's just like art. Like every line in my art is meaningful in the sense that I stress over it. I want it to be perfect. I want it to look right. So even the sales of stuff. I mean, we were kind of talking the other night about how certain things are not only the for example, food. If you're talking about organic, it's not only the food itself, but it's actually everything that goes around it. Like, you know, what are the inputs? What are the harvesting tools? What are the transportation? Like all those things have to be organic as well, and that has nothing to do with like the food that you actually are eating. It's just the way that the human actions that are around that. So I think like my art, I tend to do it in that way. So because I just had felt that I didn't really want to be a part of that anymore, but I still wanted to sell my art and I loved the Bitcoin auction format, that I just wanted to kind of do that on my own. So I basically built the site just for myself so I could do my own Bitcoin only auctions. That was the original vision. Because I just felt like I said, I wanted to continue doing it. I wanted to do something. Like if I don't feel in line with things, then I can't put my all into it, you know? So I think by removing that middleman, then I tend not to do collaborations with other people, cause I like to be very specific with my direction. And I know where I'm going and I want to be there and I don't want to compromise. So by doing it myself, I didn't have to compromise. And the Bitcoin Atlantis thing really helped in many ways, because I wanted to do that. I was being a little lazy about it. But then when they asked me to do the gallery, they also said, well, can we use your site to do the auctions if you're doing that? And I was like, okay, yes. And I said yes before I had it fully built. So I was like, okay, like I need to actually like get in and do it. So I did have like 5 or 6 months to do it. So it was plenty of time, because it was like half-ish done. But I think going from half done to full done takes more time than the first half, because you really have to refine everything. So it helped me advance so much, because now I felt responsible for other people. Like it wasn't just me that I had to do it right for. I had actually like responsibility for all these other people that were going to do it through the site as well. So that made me want to do it as best as possible. So I, you know, I was able to go through it, build it up, and we actually had 80 auctions and they went, you know, really well. You know, you always have some bugs when you expose software to the public, but it, to me, I think went super well. All the artists did extremely well. We had 4 or 5 auctions that didn't get paid for. And that's because I didn't put deposit requirements on it. I was a little worried. We were going through this like high fee spam attack at the time. And fees were like almost, I don't know what they were. Let's say $100 for a transaction or $50 for a transaction. So if you're going to leave a deposit on an auction, you know, to do that on main chain was very expensive. So I was worried that would cause people not to bid in the auction. So I said, oh, you know, eBay is like the biggest auction place in the world. They don't make people put deposits, so it should be fine. And so I did that. But yeah, so there was like, I would say of the 80 auctions, so, you know, 75 got paid for. We had 5 that didn't. But for the 5 that didn't, it definitely hurt, you know, because you kind of think you have that there and whatever. So this time we put deposit requirements.
And around how many Bitcoin in total for like went around those, like, what was on the site during Madeira? Like, did it handle
a lot?
Have to give away the exact number.
Yeah, it handled everything perfectly. It was a BTC Pay server is the back end of it. So it functions extremely well. That's another thing is like, okay, so the auction site allows me to be self-sovereign in the auctions, but so does the BTC Pay server. Without that critical piece,
super cool,
I couldn't do it. And the neat thing is that basically the website platform I use is called PrestaShop. And PrestaShop is interesting because they are open source, free open source website development platform, e-commerce platform. So you can actually, you know, install PrestaShop for free and you have an e-commerce site, a very basic e-commerce site. And then everything on top of that is basically modules. So you can kind of plug and play, you know, your theme or the way that it looks or the functionality, all these different things. So BTC Pay Server has a module. So like I just uninstalled every payment module that it came with, all the fiat bullshit, installed BTC Pay Server. And then that is the unit of account on the website. Like everything's priced in Bitcoin.
Way to go.
Yeah. And it's super functional. I haven't had much problems. And when I do have problems, they have really good tech support. So, you know, I go over to them and say, hey, this is what's going on. And it's kind of weird that like a free software project even has good tech support, because like I have paid software where you don't even get good tech support. So, you know, it's highly commendable. And so I think like these are really important things, because these are tools that Bitcoiners are making for other Bitcoiners that allow them to be self-sovereign. And even like my art, in a way, I feel like the Bitcoiners that buy it or even that place the bids, those people are pretty much allowing me to go farther with what I've already been able to do. So it's kind of like every art piece that I have is like a step up, maybe, in a ladder. And you can't reach the next step until you've already climbed the lower ones. But it's hard to keep doing that if like no one supports you. And so I think just the support and the feedback that I get is so rewarding, you know. So like I think coming to these conferences is extremely rewarding, in the sense that if I create something and post some pictures or videos on Twitter, then that's really the only way that a lot of people ever get to see some of the art. And then it goes in a box and goes to a collector, and then it goes in their house and no, we don't ever see it again. So the opportunity to bring it in front of 5,000 people, 10,000 people, 20,000 people, and actually have them stand in front of it is really important to me.
Hey, Luke, why did the chicken brush his teeth?
Why, Knut? Do chickens even have teeth?
To get to the Bitbox on the other side of the road.
What a fantastic idea. The Bitbox is our favorite hardware wallet for a lot of reasons. It's easy to use, apparently also for chickens. Bitbox cares about your security and your privacy. They take measures to make sure they're not collecting more information about you than they need to. And they also have fantastic customer support. They get rave reviews. So if you have any issues with your Bitbox or you don't know how to use it for some reason, then they can help you out and take care of you.
So go to bitbox.swiss/freedom or use code freedom for 5% off your Bitbox right now. Hey, Luke, what's the difference between a chickpea and a Bitcoin advisor?
What, Knut?
I never had a Bitcoin advisor on my face. But you could have one in your face, because we're Bitcoin advisors.
That's right, Knut. We're working with the Bitcoin advisor, and we're all about securing your Bitcoin for the long term. The Bitcoin advisor has a collaborative multi-sig solution so that you can secure your Bitcoin for the next 20 years and beyond. Even if you lose one of your keys or something happens where it's an inheritance situation, they've got you covered and we can help you get there. So go to thebitcoinadvisor.com for more information, or you can reach out to us and book a call so that we can explain everything to you ourselves. Doesn't that sound awesome?
Sounds absolutely spectacular. It's basically boating accident insurance, isn't it?
Exactly. Although, you know, boating accidents... Well,
you could have boating accidents anyway. Like, I mean, whatever.
Go to thebitcoinadvisor.com today.
Do the things.
Well, we spoke about, touched a bit on the travel restrictions, but traveling with art is no walk in the park in itself, even if there are no other restrictions, right?
Sure.
So can you tell us a bit about that? The stress of shipping these things across the world?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of stress with shipping them across the world. Like, I hadn't actually experienced that before. Many times, I've shipped a whole bunch of sculptures all over the planet. I've done art for a long time. And I even had an Etsy store where we shipped everything all over the world. And I never had, like, much trouble with customs and stuff. But Portugal definitely had some issues with customs that I ran into. And it, you know, it wasn't even on the way in, but on the way out, we had issues. And that kind of led to the creation of the current project that I had, because when we had, I don't know how far to get into this, but but like, just to quickly say, like, the current one that I was making, I wasn't even going to go to Prague, cause I just had a whole bunch of like crazy things going on, and I just didn't think I could make something in time. It just, usually when I make a sculpture, it's multi-month thing. And I only had about a month and a half left at this time. So I even told the people at Prague, I was like, I don't think I can come, because it's just, you know, how am I going to make something, ship it out there and do all this? And actually had a conversation with another artist friend of mine, and his name's Asa Noah. He's a really cool Bitcoin artist. And he told me that I can't miss the opportunity. You know, like, we just had a halving. How could you not go to the thing? You got to go and just see, you know, display some art. He said, don't do one of your big production pieces. Just do something simple. You know, maybe you can do like three small things that fit in your carry-on, and then you won't have to ship it. And when he said that, it like a light clicked on in my head. It kind of made it seem like, oh, now this is possible, because if it's something that I don't have to trust someone else to, like, you know, hold, or even if I have to, I don't even like trusting the guys to do the under the carriage, like the checked baggage. So if it's a carry-on size, then that I can actually do. So I thought that was awesome. And that basically flipped the script for me. So that weekend I said, all right, if I can come up with a design, then I can go to Prague. And if I don't come up with a design, then I have to stay home.
This is so funny, because like, just how taxes shape architecture over the centuries.
Yes.
The airline rules for how big a hand luggage, carry-on luggage can be, is actually shaping art.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I did the research. I said, okay, what size, you know, what's the max size? And, you know, I saw, okay, you can go up to 22 inches long. And, you know, you can go about 16 inches wide. So 22 inches long, you know, Bitcoin, like, we got 21 then. So, okay. So I basically designed them all at 21 inches. But like, that turned out to be a little tricky, because bags actually have a little extra stuff on the side. And if I want to put padding and protect it, like, that wasn't 100% thought through. So like, after I bought my first bag, I cut like a little test one just to see if it would fit. And that shit didn't fit in there at all. So I was like, okay. I work in something called Illustrator. It's vector art. So it's extremely easy to resize. All you do is you just take it and you just say, this is the size I want it. So basically I had only done the first one by the time I made that mess up. So I was able to do the other two at the correct size. But the first one I just resized. And to be honest, like, when I put that one in the case, it didn't fit either. And I ended up having to buy like three or four different carry-on cases just to find the one that would fit. And in the end, none of those actually worked. I had to just buy a duffel bag that was slightly larger, because what I did was I basically knew the size of the pieces. So I custom designed these exact size little rectangles that were basically 3/4 of an inch smaller than the max required size on any side. And then I basically sandwiched them in, so it was a perfect rectangle. And then I put them in a duffel bag, and it was like the exact size that you needed to get. I even like was like a little stressed that it was going to fit in their carry-on box. So the first day, I went like 3 hours early just to like, no one would see me. And I'm just like checking it out, and like goes in. I'm like, yes. If it didn't go in, I don't know what I would have done. I was like, I was just going to argue with them and say like, I can't go if this can't go. No,
but I'm so like amazed by the stress that must go into like, I sell books at conferences, sure, right? And I sign books and whatnot. And they come in boxes and they all look the same. And like, they have a fairly low production cost, and there's a fairly low profit on them. And it's like, so there's no like, if anything happens or shipment doesn't arrive, it's not the end of the world. And like, you handle it. Seeing your pieces, which is like, half a year's work,
yes,
in is one thing,
yes,
and that thing, if anything happens to it, that's like 6 months of work down the drain, right?
So absolutely, worry just driving it from my house to the airport, because like someone could hit us as we're, you know, we can get into an accident and then it could be destroyed. And no, man, like, it was a super high stress. And when I went at first, the ticket guy, he was like, oh, we could check that for you for free at no cost. It looks pretty big. And I was like, no, I'm not checking this. And then, when I went around to the side to get in, it didn't have some kind of sticker. And at first they argued, and they didn't want to give me a sticker. Then I went back and I'm like, you need to put a sticker on this bag, because it's coming with me. Like, it's extremely high stress, because like you said, this is 6 months of my life and I'm holding it with me. I'm sorry, you're not giving it to none of these people. And I would go home, you know, instead. And so, yes, it's extremely high stress in that sense. But I also was stressed because my wife said, TSA is most likely going to want to open those cases and look at it, which made perfect sense to me, because like, she's like, you're basically walking through the security with three Stargates, you know?
Yeah.
They're going to be curious to see what the hell's going on. So I kind of made it so that it would have been easy for me to open them up. I even put my little white gloves and stuff. So if I had to open it up, because the TSA always has gloves too. So I figured, you know, we'll be able to rock and roll with it. But whatever, I put it through the thing, totally expecting them to be like, but they didn't even look at it. It just went right through came back to me. And I was like, okay, let's go. And yeah, so that like, it was like a lot of that where things just kind of kept working out in the right way. You know, I was able to get in. I was able to get in with a little bit, you know, large looking bag. You know, they didn't search the stuff. And not that it would have been a problem if they searched it. I just don't want people touching things that they're not supposed to. You know.
Yeah, yeah. And they have such skewed incentives.
Like, exactly.
They have to catch one or two or like look through one or two on a, like every hundredth bag or something.
Because otherwise that,
they're
right?
not doing their job. And so they do random stuff. And I've seen when I worked on the tall ship like ages ago, there was one of the students who went from, we flew from Cartagena, Colombia via Miami, via, I think, Charles de Gaulle in Paris and back to Sweden. And when we come out of the of the airport, he's like, oh, holy shit, I've had this on me all the way. And there's like a $5 wrench literally in his back pocket. And he had just gone through all of those machines in all of the airports. It's like so much of it is just random and just fake.
Right.
And it's just there to scare people.
Man, you would think, yeah, the metal wrench of all things would have raised an alarm.
Yeah,
like,
but
you know.
Apparently it worked. He could walk through.
Oh, wow.
Three continents.
That would have made me even more paranoid. It's not even the fact that they look like Stargates. You might just be the number. Like, oh, you're the random guy that we pick. So, yeah, and it's one of those things that I went very early just to deal with any nonsense. Like, I don't want to, like, hey, if they're going to pull this out, they're probably going to, what is this? And I'm going to have to lie and say that it's, like, you know, an astronomical thing that I'm going to talk at a math conference about. Because I don't want to just get into the Bitcoin thing with some strangers.
That's not entirely false either.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not a lie, but it's, you know, coloring the truth, you know. Like, the thing is like, if I say, like, this is a cryptographic computer that creates Bitcoin keys, then, you know, that might just be too interesting.
Yeah. How do you handle the stress? Like, do you have ways of handling that type of stress?
I mean, I think it's just like cannabis is probably the answer. So yeah, no, I think that my composition is such that I have been through a lot of stressful events in the past. So I kind of have some training, like, you know, if you exercise certain muscles, then you get like a little stronger. I just seem to always have the craziest shit happen to me. So like, I like amp up my stress exercise and I think I'm just a tiny bit more resilient and adaptive, which helps me because life is just tough, dude. You know, you just run into just so many obstacles. And I think like the important thing is like kind of we were saying with the TV, you just can't let that stuff stop you because I'm on a mission here. I'm on a mission to actually do things that are very cool for Bitcoin. I don't know what that is exactly, but the mission is to make cool stuff for Bitcoin. And I think like that's important and that's what I need to focus on. And anything that distracts from that, I have to ruthlessly kind of, excommunicate that from my life and really be purposeful about what I spend my time on. That's why, you know, because a lot of times I'll spend a lot of time working on a project that just never manifests. Like, oh, you know, you think this is cool, you're working on it. And it actually may be super cool, but then I'll get distracted, you know, like I'll get like this momentary like idea and it's like, oh, you kind of have to follow that for a minute and just see where that goes. And I've had so many of my pieces just arise like that. And even this one is basically like that. I had started that Codex 32 thing months and months ago. It was in circles, didn't even look like this. I started sketching out the rectangle thing after I got back from Madeira a little. But if I showed you what I started the weekend with, and I will, I'm going to have to show you now and we'll post pictures of it. It's like kindergarten level chicken scratch type stuff. I mean, all I did was place the items. Like, this is where it's going to go. Like, zero design work is just a bunch of like nothing. And then, but this is actually part of a much bigger project. Like, I'm working on this Codex 32, like a full on computer. This one has most everything that you need, but there's a lot missing. There's a lot of other things that would be really nice if you could just integrate it all in the whole piece. So there's no additional worksheets that you need or no additional lookup tables. But to do that, it's going to have to be a relatively grand, large piece. And the funny thing is people always ask me, they're like, oh, this is big. Can you do something smaller? And it's like, first, my friend told me, can you do something simple? He don't know I can't do simple. And it's not that I can't do small. I just, I just like to do a lot of details. So in order to fit in as much as I can, it kind of starts enlarging. Like I'll start with a small thing and then I'm like, oh, I need to make this a little bigger. So this is, So things just kind of start to move. And I think I just like that better. Like I'm not the kind of guy that's going to make 200 of these little things over and over and over again, because I like to kind of do things different because I help grow as a person and an artist and an individual. So I'd rather spend 6 months working on something that's actually almost too hard for me to do, like where I don't think I can do this, rather than a production thing that, okay, I've built these skills and I know I can do this and I can kind of repetitively complete this process. I'd rather do something that's actually scary in the sense that we're going to invest money, we're going to invest resources, we're going to invest time, and we have zero guarantees here. You know what I'm saying? So those type of risks are important to take, because if you fail at like 10 of them, it's not a big deal if you can crush one of them, because then that's something that was impossible for you before. And that's now become something that's possible. So it kind of broadens your sphere of what you can do as a person and an artist. And once you have that, then that's the conquered realm. Now you can additionally level up and do something else that you couldn't do. And that's kind of what drives me forward in this. So the Codex 32 project that I'm working on, actually the three separate pieces are all actually one dice tower. So the three actually combine into a triangle, and you're able to put dice right on the top and they come down. And at the bottom of each Codex 32, there's like a little door window. It's almost like a temple entrance. And then the dice will come out of that onto the platform. And yeah, I'm really excited for this. I think it's going to be super cool. And it's just going to take me a little while. And I think like the cool thing is this project was like an incremental step, because it helps to show me that this is possible, you know, because like I was saying, there's zero guarantees that I'm going to be able to do this vision in my head. But by taking this little incremental step, it really made it seem like, okay, number one, this is cool. And people are interested in it too. So it's not like you're spending a year on something that people are like, okay, well, that's cool. You know, very interesting. But I got such a overwhelming response from all the people that I talked to at the event. Because I think like as an artist, you have your high watermarks. And I think for me, it's the full node sculpture. That's kind of like, I always would like to make something that's at that level. And I had some people that were telling me, oh, this is either at that. I even had some people that told me that was better. I don't know if I believe it, but it was very rewarding to hear that. Cause it's kind of like, hey, maybe you can reach that high level. It's not like, oh, once you do something great, you maybe never get to that level again. It's like, no, actually, if you do work, you may be able to find a path into not only that level, but actually higher than that. So I think that,
no, I think I'm trying to do. This one is right up there.
Wow.
with the full node statue. I mean, I don't know which one of your pieces I love the most. Of course, the Infinity Keys is special and close to my heart. And like, for me, that's what I'm aiming to top. And I don't think I'll ever like that thing with all of its history and Infinity Day and all of this weird stuff that happened around it. That things like that just don't happen twice. Like,
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. See, I guess we go through the same stuff, even though we work in different mediums. It's like the same questioning yourself. Like, can I like once I've achieved a certain level of like, hey, this is very interesting, cool thing. You know, can you ever do that again? And I think the answer is obviously yes. It's just, it's difficult.
Well,
as hell.
The answer is, well, if you don't try, you can't. Like that. It's certain that you can't if you don't try. So like,
that's the important
regardless
thing.
And you should never forget that if you had something that got a lot of attention because people like it, then you're lucky. Like,
sure, absolutely.
It's a blessing. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah, that I think the luck is 100% part of it. But I was going to also say, if you have something that people thought is interesting, to some degree, that all came from within you.
Yeah,
you know, it's like something that you were able to take from nothing and kind of bring into the world, and then other people react to it however they react to it. I think that's so cool with the art that I do, is that I can kind of have an idea in the morning. I could sketch it up on the computer before lunch. I could go out to the laser and just cut it up, and I have it in my hand in a couple hours. It's basically like a magic wand. You've just taken some, you know, thought and turned it into reality.
Yeah, that's super
magic.
Cool.
Yeah,
that's what writing feels like. Well, and we've had a lot of conversations about creativity in general, you and I, because like it's such a it's such an odd beast to try to tame, right? And I really love like listening to other people's processes about it. So when you say that it came from within,
sure.
Like the weirdest thing for me is like the best creative work I've done ever done is sort of feels like it comes from outside of me, and I'm sort of channeling something. Do you have like a similar feeling?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think like that, and I actually heard kind of a little snippet the other day where I think Quentin Tarantino was talking to another actress, and they had a similar conversation, and I think that is a common feeling, because when I'm actually doing my best work, like you're saying, I find myself to usually be in a state where, you know, it's the flow state, in the sense that things are kind of timeless. I'm actually just kind of working and things are just kind of falling into place. And I was telling you that last night, I have the two types of production that I usually try to settle into for art. I always say, create high, edit sober. And that basically means that, you know, like you have a space for each, you know, you have a space to be highly creative where you're not too worried about boundaries. You actually just kind of want to create form or shape to your idea. And you understand that that's not the final form. You know, you're just trying to release what's within you. And I think that's the part that I think comes from without me. And then like, there's an ordering part of the art that I do where it's like, okay, now we have like a basic idea. Now let's bring form to the shape. So things like these sculptures where I actually had to make them function first. So I'll do like a function over form at first. So first you have to make sure the device functions. If not, then it's worthless. So once you have the function down, then you can actually start, you know, seeing what it looks like. And I think like both of these things are relevant.
It reminds me so much about music, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about improvising or doing your own songs or doing covers or whatever. Like you need some form of orderliness. Like you need to know what you're doing.
Your time signature, your beat.
But you also need to be creative and like make choices on the spot and listen and try to convey a feeling, which is completely different. I think it's like a right brain, left brain sort of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and as you say that, it actually brought me to some of the way that I do the art. A lot of it is like that in a way, in improvisation. Almost like even to the point when I'm cutting pieces out, it's very tricky, because when I do the design work, I do it all mostly. I either use it in Illustrator, which would be entirely 2D, or I do some stuff in Fusion, which is 3D. The 3D stuff, you actually get a lot better sense of what it looks like, because the software lets you kind of roll it around. You can see if things fit, and you can actually even do some physics with it, and I can like do gearing and things. It's pretty neat. But I don't do a lot of my work because I'm more comfortable in Illustrator, which is a vector program. I kind of interchange between the two. But like for the full node sculpture, I didn't know how to use Fusion at first, so I did everything in Illustrator. So all I have at the end when I'm done with the design is basically what you could think of as a coloring book page. It basically is just like the black and white version of it. And in fact, it doesn't look how it would when it's done, because it's all separated out into different pieces. So when you see the full node, you're actually looking at, you know, hundreds of pieces that I've cut individually. So I have each one of those as a separate design file. And what I'm getting at is that I have no idea what it's going to look like when it's put together. All I know is like I have a little vision of it. But until I actually put it together, like when I actually get the things together, the very last piece of it is always like really cool, because now it's like I actually finally see what it looks like after all. It's like your baby's born, you know, like you actually see what they look like. And up until then, it was just a dream. And there's a lot of changes that go through. So the improvisation part is that I have this design, I'm cutting it out. When I'm cutting it out of the material, something, whether it's wood or mirror or whatever it is, sometimes it just doesn't look right. You know, like, okay, like I've cut this, it cut perfectly. I put it with the rest of it and it just doesn't mesh together. These don't go together. And that means that I either one, have to change the original design. So I go back into Illustrator, make the changes and now it works. Or I just have to cut a different material. Like sometimes like with wood is extremely tricky, because I like it to have an interplay between dark wood and light wood and, you know, and stained and shiny and all this different thing. So, sometimes it's not cohesive, the look. And so you end up cutting a whole bunch of pieces that just actually may be cool on their own, for example, but they just don't work in the piece. So I actually have like a little box of all the offcuts of things that, hey, this would be cool if it fit, but you know, it didn't. But there's actually a huge amount of stuff that you don't see going into it. And I kind of think of that as improvisation. It's like, you don't know until it's there and you're putting it in and you can see it. And it's like, okay, that doesn't work. And now I have to do this. And it's just a matter of kind of working with the materials that you have to actually bring about this form that's actually just been in your brain. And now you're trying to translate it to the world. And I think that's another thing with art that I try to do is, I can only do something that I find interesting. Cause like we were saying, it's something that I'm going to dedicate, you know, months of my life to. This is a significant amount of time in my life. If I waste that time, it's never coming back. So it has to be something important to me in order for me to dedicate some time to do art on it. So, and then for the most part, like a lot of these art projects become the most important thing to me at the time, as far as, you know, outside of family and people like that, it's actually becomes the driving force of what's kind of making me wake up in the morning is, you know, creating this vision. And I think like the main goal is to say, hey, I'm interested in this. This is why you should be interested in it, and see if other people are. And I think like a lot of people actually are interested in some of the things that I am. And sometimes they would be interested, but they just don't know it. So you bring them into it. For example, the Codex 32 thing is a really good example, for example. So Codex 32 is an obscure cryptographic spec. There's just not many people that are going to encounter it in the first place. If they did encounter it, they wouldn't think it was cool because they don't know what it does. They don't understand it. And they just wouldn't take the time to learn about it. And it just wouldn't come in contact with their life. Even the people that made Codex 32, like, they have the problem of how do you get people interested in it? You know, like we've worked really hard on this project, and there's probably, you know, only a handful of people in the world that will really understand the math, and then maybe like another bunch of them that will sit there and do it. So how do we get people to know that this is something cool that they might want to use? So I think art is an amazingly powerful tool because, okay, I made some, you know, I made the art, I made some videos of it. And now basically the little video that I put on Twitter, I think had almost 150,000 views, maybe almost 200,000 by now. And that's 200,000 people that maybe they didn't watch the whole video, but they now have been exposed to Codex 32, and they probably, I would say 199,000 wouldn't have, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and probably 199,900 still don't understand what it is.
That's fine. That's fine. In fact, my wife was telling me when I was making it, she's like, I don't understand this. Like, I'm sure all your Bitcoiner friends are going to know exactly what this is, but this is a little much for me. And I was like, no, I think Codex 32 is a little esoteric for everybody, but I think that's perfect. I like that.
So did any of the Codex 32 developers like reach out to you or talk to you about it?
Yeah.
Have you talked to them?
I kind of did it like I did for your book, where I didn't tell anybody I was doing that until it was already done. So I basically just did the work, and then I was a little nervous to send it to him because I think like it's like any kind of art that I make, I'm always nervous to show it to people. So even though I had displayed it to the world, I didn't actually send them a direct link, but I did have to message them because I had a question when I was actually using the Codex 32 to make some keys. I had a problem with one of the results, and I thought like I didn't understand it, so I actually had to message them because I wanted to make sure the Codex 32 actually worked, that I could use it if I was going to put my time and actually make an art project with it. So the first time I did it, the interesting thing is if you do the math wrong when you're doing the Codex 32 math, it's very obvious because at the end you should get a specific result. It says secret share 32, and that's a factor of that Betch 32 addition that I was saying. So every time you multiply a letter times a number or whatever it is, it gives you another result. So at the end, your final result would be this secret share 32. If you mess up early in the calculation, you get totally jumbled stuff and you're not even close. But what I did was I messed up one little character all the way towards the end of it. So I got like secret share 32, but instead of the S, it was a 3 or a 5, I think. And that just didn't make sense. And I actually did the math twice and it came up that way twice. So I thought, oh, Codex 32 is broken. Like, what the hell? This is like, how could this be? Like they're trying to perpetrate, like you can just sit here and do this and I'm getting this result. That just doesn't make sense. So I was like, I guess it must be me, but I don't know. You know, like you felt like the first time, okay, you get it wrong. The second time, that's a little weird. So I email the guy, I tell him what the problem is, you know, one of the developers, because in the Codex 32 book, it says, oh, if you have questions, you know, email this, you know, Perlwort Sneed. So I emailed them and they were like, oh, okay, well, you know, your problem is going to be in box 43. It has to be this, unless you did one of five weird purposeful things that I'm sure you didn't do. So here's how you can go back and check it. But basically, you done fucked up your math, was what he told me.
All right, all right.
And he was right. Even though I did it twice, I did it incorrectly twice.
Yeah.
And that, when I actually did it right, and he said, oh yeah, the difference between H and 3 is a 5 or something. And bro, that was the actual difference in my fucking thing. It turned out to be that it was that exact letter that he said it probably was going to be. And I had asked, like, oh, can I just maybe, like, do the math backwards and that will show me? He's like, no, you actually have to go back and just, you know, look and see if you did it right, because he's like, you know, you didn't. And yeah, within 30 minutes, I went back and I saw what it was, and I was amazed. I was like, okay, so this is what it is. And yes, it's frustrating to go through it and do it, and it's not right. And because that means that you have to do it again, and it takes about an hour or two to generate a key. But if it's a key you're generating to hold Bitcoin in for 1,000 years, you know, the hour or two is commensurate. Like, you're not, I don't think that that's too much. And you have to verify it. So once you create the key, you always have to verify it. You do everyone twice just to be sure. And I messed up every key at least once. When I was doing the keys, I made a 2 of 3 setup. Each of the three keys, I did the math wrong once on it. So I had to do them all 3 times at least. But it was really cool because you just get better at it as you go on. It's a little meditative to go through the process. And but the fact is, like, once you hit that secret share 32, it's like, damn, you know, like, your keys integrity is shared for 1,000 years. You don't have to worry about it. If you don't hit that, then, you know, you messed up.
Yeah. I mean, if this sounds complicated, you can always just download Wallet of Satoshi or buy the ETF or something.
Exactly.
All right, Luke. Let's talk about Riga, why people should go to Riga this specific year. There is so much here. I mean, Riga Bitcoin Week this year is absolutely fantastic. It starts off with Noob Day, and following Noob Day, our own Infinity Day party at the basement bar, which is just spectacular. And there's a rumor going around that it'll be some free drinks or something. So that's just great. And after that, it's the Freedom On Conference, which is a Nostr-themed freedom couple of days before the actual Riga conference, Baltic Hunting Badger conference, starts. And after that, of course, it's BTC Pay Server Day. And there are karaoke nights and official parties and whatnot. So come celebrate Infinity Day and the launch of The Inverse of Clown World, our new book, in Riga this year. Of course, 21st of August, use code FREEDOM for 10% off your Riga ticket. Don't miss this.
Couldn't have said it better myself. I have nothing to add.
You don't need to add. This was the ad.
Oh, okay. Back to the show.
Anyway, you mentioned this, the beginning of, like, that's how we got to know one another, is when I noticed it was from one of your videos on
Twitter.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yeah, and I saw my book title, Sovereignty Through Mathematics, on one of the rings of the thing, and I'm super excited, and I DM'd you, and you said that you listened to the book while you made the statue, and that's how our friendship started, and now we've been total super bros for years now after that.
I told you I was so worried about that. You know, just like I said, I was worried to kind of show these Codex 32 guys the art that I did. I was worried for you to see that a little, because I didn't know how you were going to react. You might say, like, hey, you put my book title in your art without asking me, what kind of bullshit is this? But that's why I like to do it first. And, you know, I always say it's better to ask for forgiveness than...
permission.
Beg forgiveness then ask permission, because exactly. You know, then it's already done. Like, what can we do?
Well, Fractal, it's fantastic to have you back in Europe and that we get to hang out and then do stuff together. I treasure your friendship a lot, and our conversations and our little stupid projects together. I think it's fantastic.
So happy. Great. I stole your book title.
Anything else on your mind you want to tell people about?
Anywhere you want to send our listeners?
Well, I guess if you want to check me out on Twitter, I'm at Fractal Encrypt, and then I also have the website that we were talking about that we had the auctions on. I do have some art there that you could just check out anytime. I am on Nostr as well, but I've only had like a couple posts there. So, but I do have a custom vanity end pub that I mined myself. So it's a
fractal. Of course you do. What else?
Yeah. I got that. So
yeah.
Check me out all over.
Fantastic. Well, yeah. Yeah. Always great to have you on. So, Fractal Encrypt, thanks so much.
Brother. Absolutely.
This has been the Freedom Footprint Show. Thanks for listening.